Geekscape.com. The Jews in Poland. Taken from The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit by E. Michael Jones. According to the Zohar, 1648 was to be the mystical year of resurrection, when the Jews could expect deliverance from their more than millennium-long exile. Heinrich Goetz called the Zohar that lying book and used that prediction to impugn the entire Kabbalistic tradition. Since the Enlightenment was in some ways a result of the disappointment over the failure of the messianic expectations in the second half of the 17th century, his scepticism is understandable, as is his scorn for the Kabbalah, the mishmash of what he considered Gnostic and Talmudic mumbo-jumbo that had led to the rise and fall of messianic hope. Goetz espoused a worldview that was the antithesis of the messianic fever of the mid-17th century. He was convinced in his opposition to the Kabbalah because he had the benefit of historical hindsight and could see where its vaporous illusions had led the Jewish people. Expectation of redemption, fostered by widespread dissemination of Kabbalistic doctrine, made the Jews, in Goetz's words, more reckless and careless than was their custom at other times. Just what Goetz meant by reckless can be seen in his analysis of Polish Jewry, a hotbed of Kabbalistic thought. Beginning with the Statute of Kaliz in 1251, the Jews of Poland were granted rights unlike anywhere else in Europe. They were even granted their own autonomous legal system, the Kahal, which allowed them to adjudicate intra-Jewish disputes without recourse to the Polish Christian legal system. This autonomy necessitated intensive study of the Talmud, which, according to Goetz, led to the peculiar corruption of Polish Jews. The reliance on the Talmud created a culture of hair-splitting judgment among rabbis, says Goetz, as well as a love of twisting, distorting, ingenious quibbling, and a foregone antipathy to what did not lie within their field of vision, which trickled down to the behaviour of the vulgar, who found pleasure and a sort of triumphant delight in deception and cheating. By the end of the 18th century, the overwhelming majority of Jews lived in Poland, so Jews earned the reputation of being a nation of deceivers, in Immanuel Kant's formulation. It does indeed seem strange. Kant, the quintessential Enlightenment philosopher, continued to conceive of a nation of deceivers, but it is also very strange to conceive of a nation of merchants, the majority of whom, bound by an ancient superstition accepted by the state they live in, do not seek any civil dignity, but prefer to make good this disadvantage with the benefits of trickery, at the expense of the people who shelter them, and at the expense of each other. In a nation of merchants, unproductive members of society, it cannot be otherwise. From his vantage point in Königsberg, the capital of East Prussia, a country that the Teutonic Knights wrested by force from the Slavic natives, all Jews were Polish Jews. Goetz, the Enlightenment Jew, an apostle of German culture, and Jewish assimilation to it, echoed Kant, but confined his censure to the Jews of Poland, who, according to his judgment, acquired the quibbling method of the schools and employed it to outwit the less cunning. Piety and knowledge of the hair-splitting distinctions of the Talmud became one and the same for the Polish Jew, a combination which, when added to the dogmatism of the rabbis, undermined their moral sense and made them prone to sophistry and boastfulness. Largely as a result of the concessions of the Polish crown, which began with the Statute of Kaliz, Poland became known throughout Europe as the Paradisius Judaeorum, the paradise of the Jews. When persecutions would flare up in traditionally Jewish sections of Europe, like the German principalities, the Jews who wished to escape persecution inevitably headed east towards Poland, taking their language, Jewish Deutsch or Yiddish, with them. When Isaac Bashevis Singer won the Nobel Prize towards the end of the 20th century, he was designated a Pole by the selection committee, in spite of his candid admission that he understood Polish only with difficulty, even though he lived his entire youth in Poland. Jews did not assimilate in Poland. Most did not learn the language of the Christian Poles, because other than rudimentary commerce and illicit sexual activity, the Jews had no contact with them. The Jews established their own state within a state. They established their own legal system and courts, and based on demographic evidence, the Polish paradise was the most successful modus vivendi Jews found in the West. Between 1340 and 1772, at which point Poland was partitioned for the first time, the Jewish population of Poland increased 75-fold, while the Christian population only quintupled. The disparity in population increase is explainable in simple terms. Persecution in the West from the 11th to the 16th century caused massive immigration. Jews moved to Polish territory during that period of time in unprecedented numbers. By the time Poland was partitioned for the third time in 1795, 80% of the world's Jews lived there. This phenomenal expansion of the Jewish population in Poland was matched by a correspondingly rapid increase in wealth that in turn corresponded to a dramatic expansion of the territorial limits of Poland. The Golden Age of Polish Jews, according to Poganowski, lasted from 1500 to 1648. By 1634, Poland was the largest country in Europe. Its territory extended from the Baltic almost to the Black Sea, and from Silesia in the west to the heart of the Ukraine. By the middle of the 17th century, as much as 60% of Poland's population was not ethnically Polish, a situation bound to cause friction, depending on how wisely the Polish rulers treated their ethnic subjects. What followed was a classical case of cultural drift in which imperial expansion covered over internal decay until the contradictions and injustices became so insupportable that the bubble burst and an orgy of violence followed, dragging the Polish state to extinction. The story of Poland was the story of imperial Rome writ small. Imperial expansion to the east, into what is now the Ukraine, the Crimea, and Belarus, resulted in creation of huge estates, some the size of Holland and Switzerland. The estates were called latifundia, an ironic comment on the blindness of the Polish nobility, who failed to see the mischief the latifundia system had wrought in ancient Rome. The Polish nobles' republic was a classic oligarchy, as Plato defined the term in his Republic. As in ancient Greece, so in Poland, wealth concentrated in fewer and fewer hands led to rebellion among the lower classes. Wealth concentrated in fewer and fewer hands fueled imperialism, in which the chief losers were the overwhelming majority of the Polish people. As in ancient Rome, the citizen soldiers were driven to the wall by the monopoly conditions the latifundia fostered. When the rebellion came, all Poles would be held responsible for the excesses of the magnates who created the system that dispossessed the average Polish citizen. The citizen soldiers, who had been the backbone of the Republic's legions, became the disenfranchised rural proletariat once wealth was concentrated in the hands of the magnates. The citizen soldiers who owned small and medium estates, Poganowski says, suffered numerous bankruptcies and were becoming landless while still retaining their full civil rights and privileges. As a result, many of them had to seek employment in the huge estates called latifundia. This meant more and more political power migrated to the land magnates who now employed the enfranchised. As a result, the political machines of the owners of the Latifundia enabled them to attain an oligarchic control of the politics of Poland. Their control of the national parliament was based on their grip of the provincial legislatures. In 1633, the Sejm passed a law forbidding Poland's nobility from selling liquor or engaging in commercial activities. The Polish nobility retained, as a result, political control of the country, but lost economic control. Because the Polish magnates owned the land, but were unable to engage in commerce, they handed over income extraction to the Jews, who paid a set fee for a lease to raise the money the nobles needed. The system of prepaid short-term leases was known as arenda. The connection between arenda tax farming and the Jews was so intimate that it eventually was expressed in the Polish language. In legal contracts in the 17th and 18th century, the Polish word arendarz, or tax farmer, and Jew are synonymous. According to Poganowski, 15% of urban and 80% of rural Jewish heads of households were occupied within the arenda system. The Jewish legal system, or kahal, brokered these licenses to well-to-do Jews, who in turn often subleased them to less well-to-do relatives. In Polish private law, arenda was defined as the leasing of immovable property or rights. The subject of the lease might be a whole territory held either in ownership or in pledge, or the subject might be a tavern, mill, or the right to collect various payments, such as a bridge toll or a payment connected with jurisdiction. A Jew, for example, might take out a short-term lease on a church in defiance of church law. This meant he was in sole possession of the key to the church door, which could only be opened for weddings or baptisms after payment of a fee, a practice that led to resentment among Christians. Since the lease was short-term, the Jew would charge as much as he could to recoup his investment and some profit, since the lease might not be renewed. Or, if it were renewed, someone might outbid him. There was no financial incentive to create goodwill among the local population from which the arenda made his money. The Jewish tax farmers had the support of the state. Poganowski estimates 20 to 70% of the income of the large estates was generated by tax farming leases held by Jews, but lacked the goodwill of the community. Since the Jew was not a part of that community, and had developed, as Goetz indicates, a whole culture, treating the goyim with contempt, he could exploit the system well beyond what would have been tolerable had Catholic Poles run the system. Quote, arenda-type short-term leases resulted in intensive exploitation of the leased estates, as the lessees tended to overwork the land, peasants and equipment, without worrying about long-term effects. The peasants experienced additional hardships when Jewish arendars obtained the right to collect and even impose taxes and fees for church services. The peasants and Cossacks in Krizi, the newly colonized lands of the East, bitterly resented having to pay Jews for the use of Eastern Orthodox and Greek Catholic churches for funerals, baptisms, weddings, and other similar occasions. Because of the arenda system and the prohibition against nobles distilling spirits, the Jews assumed control of the liquor business. They could manipulate the price of grain by diverting it to more profitable use as distilled spirits. They also intensely promoted alcohol consumption to maximize profits during the short term of the lease. This led to chronic drunkenness, decreased productivity, and increased resentment against Jews, who were perceived as constantly seeking to exploit the weaknesses of the majority to enhance their own wealth and power. Gretz talks about the Jew who has experienced in financial matters as a salutary counterbalance to the impetuous, headstrong, and ultimately childlike Polish nobleman. Quote, "The high nobility continued to be dependent on Jews, who, in a measure, counterbalanced the national defects. Polish flightiness, levity, unsteadiness, extravagance and recklessness were compensated for by Jewish prudence, sagacity, economy and cautiousness. The Jew was more than a financier to the Polish nobleman. He was his help in embarrassment, his prudent adviser, his all in all." There are other ways of viewing the unique utilitarian alliance between the huge landowners and the Jewish financial elite. Looked at one way, Jewish migration to Poland brought Jewish capital that was soon put at the disposal of the Polish crown and the landowning magnates, whose estates expanded dramatically. The Polish magnates then used the Jews and their money to expand the Polish empire into the fertile steppes of the Ukraine, Belarus, and the northern shore of the Black Sea. Looked at another way, this alliance concentrated the wealth into fewer and fewer hands, especially during the Jewish colonization in the Ukraine, in the 80 years between 1569 and 1648. Since the leases involved monopoly rights, the Jewish tax farmers could increase the political power of their wealthy patrons, and their own wealth and influence as well, by driving the smaller independent landowners to the wall. The short-term increase in power, though, increased the magnitude and violence of the reaction when it came. The success of the new system contained within it the seeds of its own destruction. The radical disjunction between political and economic power meant the enfranchised noble citizens gradually lost control of their culture. The easygoing Polish oligarchs wedded to an economic system that seemed so successful in bringing new lands under the Polish crown did not understand control over those territories was undermined from within by the very people that administered it. This happened gradually, of course, and it manifested itself first in religion. Flush with the short-term wealth which the arenda system created and the territorial expansion which it enabled, the Polish kings ignored the biggest cultural crisis of their day, the Protestant revolt against Catholic hegemony over Europe. Because there was no Inquisition in Poland, Poland became a model for tolerance, paving the way for its own extinction. While the Duke of Parma was battling Calvinists and Jews in the Netherlands and setting up a barrier beyond which the Reformation would not pass, helping to save southern Europe from the rebellion which had devastated England and the north, Sigismund August II, ruler of Poland and Lithuania, surrounded himself with Jews and the Protestant revolutionaries the Poles called Demi-Jews. The Reformers in Poland were largely Unitarian Socinian followers of Michael Servetus, who, in Gretz's words, undermined the foundations of Christianity by rejecting the veneration of Jesus as a divine person. Flush with the money they provided, King Sigismund indulged his disordered passions and handed the country over to Jewish and demi-Jewish administrators to rule as they wished. Peasants groaned under the predations of the Jewish tax farmers, who in turn lent money to the king at less usurious interest rates, keeping him under their power too. Rabbi Mendel Frank of Brest, says Walsh, was so influential that he was called the king's officer. As in England, the Polish nobles were torn between religious principle and economic interest. As in England, economic consideration won out, and the nobility in most cases held its protecting hand over the Jews, to whom it was tied by the community of economic interests. the Polish oligarchs were either in debt to the Jews or employed them to squeeze taxes for them out of the peasants, naturally at a good profit for the tax farmers who took their tolls from dairies, mills, distilleries and farms. The Jews were indispensable to the easy-going magnate who was wont to let his estates take care of themselves and while away his time at the capital, at the court, in merry amusements, or at the tumultuous sessions of the national and provincial assemblies, where politics was looked upon as a form of entertainment rather than as a serious pursuit. The Polish aristocracy put a check on the anti-Semitic endeavours of the clergy. The Jesuits warred with the Jews over the mind of the Polish oligarchs, but there was no Inquisition and no counter-reformation in Poland. As a result, Calvinism, Socinianism, and Unitarianism spread among the nobles unchecked by official Catholic resistance, so Poland became, in Gretz's words, a second Babylon for the Jews. By the death of Sigismund II in 1572, the Jews had attained enough power to name his successor, in collaboration with the Porte in Constantinople, the Huguenots in France, and the English Protestants. Solomon ben Nathan Ashkenazi, although sponsor to the Duke of Ferrara, was involved in negotiations regarding a later king. Solomon Ashkenazi was a German Jew who had migrated to the paradise of the Jews, where he eventually became chief physician to King Sigismund. He eventually migrated to Constantinople, where he served the Sultan as faithfully as he had served the Polish king. Solomon Ashkenazi succeeded Joseph Nazi, also an advisor to the Sultan as a sort of unofficial leader of world Jewry. Like Nazi, Ashkenazi orchestrated events from behind the scenes. Christian cabinets, Gretz says, did not suspect that the course of events which compelled them to side with one party or the other was set in motion by a Jewish hand. This was especially so in the case of the election of the Polish king. Locked into such a profitable alliance with the Jews, the Polish magnates saw little reason to change a system from which they profited so effortlessly and enormously. As a result, the exactions of the Jewish tax farmers became onerous to the point of being intolerable among the peasantry in general, but especially among the newly colonized Cossacks, who never felt themselves a part of the Polish nation, or, as Orthodox, part of the Catholic culture of the West. The political crisis, which had been growing during the last 80 years of Polish imperial expansion, corresponded as well to the worst excesses of the arenda system. Reform of the system was urgently necessary, and a bill of reform eventually made its way to the Sejm. In 1647, as one precondition that prepared for a Polish crusade against the Ottoman Empire, the Cossacks were promised full civil rights and enfranchisement over time as Polish citizens. That meant the harsh exploitation by Jewish holders of short-time leases was to be lessened by banning the collection of such payments as church fees for funerals, weddings, and baptisms. It also meant disobedience to the tax farmers would no longer be a capital crime, and Jesuits would no longer be assigned to Cossack territory in the southern Ukraine, so they would no longer pressure Orthodox to submit to Rome's authority. Finally, the Jews were to be evicted from the southern Ukraine. When the bill came to a vote in 1648, the Sejm, dominated by the alliance of huge landowners and their Jewish administrators, defeated it, showing how the concentration of wealth and power into a few hands can enable a group to pursue its own interests in disregard of the common good over the brink of that self-interest into national disaster. The situation in Poland was roughly analogous to that in Spain a century and a half earlier, Spain was the only other country in Europe with a similarly influential Jewish population. As in Poland, many Sephardic Jews caused resentment among the lower classes. During the famine in Cuenca in 1326, Jewish usurers charged farmers 40% interest on the money they needed to borrow to buy grain for sowing. Blasphemy was a Jewish custom in Spain. Moses, according to Walsh, had condemned blasphemers to death. Yet it was a custom of many Jews to blaspheme the prophet for whom Moses had warned them to prepare. The Jews in Spain were disliked not for practicing the things that Moses taught, but for doing the things that he had forbidden. They had profited hugely on the sale of fellow beings as slaves, and practiced usury as a matter of course and flagrantly. Blasphemy went hand in hand with Jewish proselytizing, often by compulsion. Jews would force Christian servants to get circumcised as a condition of employment. They would encourage people to whom they had lent money to abjure Christ by promising to cancel their debts. For many Jews in Amsterdam, who were former victims of the Spanish Inquisition, 1648 might have been the dawn of redemption. Instead of salvation, the Polish Jews got Bogdan Chmielnicki, who brought them liberation from the ghetto, in a way they neither foresaw nor desired. The defeat in the Sejm turned the hopeful expectation of the Cossacks into equally vehement outrage. That outrage was mobilized by a Cossack leader by the name of Bogdan Chmielnicki. Chmielnicki, who was 53 years old when the Sejm voted against enfranchising the Cossacks, had a personal stake in the matter as well. A Jew by the name of Zachariah Sabalenki, according to Gretz, had played him a trick by which he was robbed of his wife and property. Another had betrayed him when he had come to an understanding with the Tatars. Besides injuries which his race had sustained from Jewish tax farmers in the Ukraine, he therefore had personal wrongs to avenge. Chmielnicki's claim, "The Poles have delivered us as slaves to the cursed breed of Jews," resonated among the Cossacks, bringing them into open revolt. When Chmielnicki and his Cossack and Tatar hordes defeated the Polish army in May 1648, widespread looting, pillaging and murder ensued. 100,000 Jews perished in the mayhem. Some pretended to be Christian to escape the wrath. Some accepted baptism as the price of saving their lives. Chmielnicki's pogroms became what the riots in Spain would have become without the benefit of the Inquisition. Resentment had built up for too long for this blaze to burn itself out quickly. The Cossacks held the Poles responsible for the behaviour of the Jews, even though the average Pole also suffered from the system of financial exploitation that enraged the Cossacks. Prince Wisniewski, whom Gretz calls the only heroic figure among the Poles at that time, did what he could to protect the Jews, but that wasn't much, given the magnitude of the forces that opposed him. In many towns, the Jews put aside their separatist instincts and allied themselves with local Catholics in mutual defence against the bloodthirsty Cossacks. Sometimes the pact succeeded, sometimes it didn't. When Chmielnicki's Cossack hordes arrived at the gates of Lvov, he demanded that all Jews within the city's walls be handed over to him as a condition of lifting the siege. The Poles refused, and many Jewish lives were saved. According to the Jewish historian Heinrich Grimberg, the Polish armies who were at war with the Cossacks were the sole defenders of the Jews. Chmielnicki's animus was directed equally against the Catholic Church and the Jews. When he was sober enough to dictate the conditions of peace after an attack, he invariably demanded expulsion of both from areas the Cossacks controlled. Poland's neighbours exploited the situation, setting in motion events that would eventually lead to Poland's partition at the end of the 18th century. Muscovy, Prussia, Sweden, Brandenburg and the Ottoman Empire all nibbled at territory Poland was too weak to defend. Poland lost, as a result, 200,000 inhabitants, half of whom were Jews. The Uniates of the Ukraine were forcibly converted to Orthodoxy, diminishing the Catholic and Polish influence on the southern flank of Lithuania, which had converted to Catholicism largely through Polish influence. The Khmelnicki pogroms, occurring in the purported Messianic Year of Redemption, strengthened those Jews who felt that Messianic deliverance, ushered in perhaps by catastrophe, was closer than ever. The idea that the Messiah would hear and answer the prayers of his people in time of need became transmuted into a belief that dire need was a sign that the Messiah's arrival was imminent. The alembic that enabled this religious alchemy was Kabbalah, which had instilled the messianic expectation in the first place. Gershom Scholem disagrees with those who see the Khmelnicki uprisings as the cause of the messianic fever that swept European Jewry during the middle of the 17th century. If the massacres of 1648 were in any sense its principal cause, Scholem argues, why did the Messiah not arise within Polish Jewry? The source of messianic fervour, according to Scholem, was none other than Lurianic Kabbalism, that is, that form of Kabbalah which had developed at Safed in Galilee during the 16th century and which dominated Jewish religiosity in the 17th century. According to the Kabbalah, catastrophe and utopianism go hand in hand. A catastrophe like the Khmelnicki massacres meant that redemption was at hand. The most immediate consequence of the Khmelnicki uprising was a massive exodus from the Jewish paradise in the east. Penniless Jewish refugees streamed west. It was at this moment that the legend of the wandering Jew was born. A race whose scriptures begin with a description of paradise and whose formative moment was escape from bondage in Egypt could not get the idea of escape into another paradise out of its head. So, having heard stories of the prospering displaced Sephardim, their impoverished Ashkenazi cousins streamed towards Hamburg and Amsterdam, the Dutch Jerusalem. Amsterdam thus became a staging area for the ongoing experimentation in revolution, which is the modern world. With the two main branches of Judaism converging in a land recently ripped by force from the Spanish Empire, a new modus vivendi was inevitable. It was the revolutionary idea, promoted by Jews, often not surprisingly full of outrage at the Inquisition, and by German-speaking Catholics, full of revulsion at the order the Church had imposed on Europe.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.